Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Kathleen Che on behalf of the appellant Tyler Bowman. If I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes it is.
Thank you. We are asking the court to reverse Mr. Bowman's convictions because the trial court admitted irrelevant and extremely prejudicial evidence at Mr. Bowman's trial. Mr. Bowman and his co-defendant were charged with 2 counts of burglary in the second degree. And over Mr. Bowman's objection, the trial court permitted the state to elicit from an officer that several weeks after the burglary, he observed Mr. Bowden and the co-defendant, Mr. Everson, walking in a similar location at the same time of night as in the commission of the burglary. The court permitted the officer to testify not only to that information, but also to information about the fact that he thought this was very strange, that he found their actions suspicious, and there were no open businesses around, and given that this was, quote, not a pedestrian trafficked area. So he was permitted not only to discuss information that suggested that these individuals were engaged in the same type of crime that was being alleged at trial, but then permitted to give his opinion about how suspicious he thought this activity was. The state.
Did Mr. Everson and Mr. Bowman testify at this trial?
No, neither one testified.
So it was relevant to establish that they knew each other.
If there was any relevance, it would have been for that, but the trial court let in everything about that encounter as opposed to just admitting evidence as to the fact Mr. Everson and Mr. Bowman were seen together at one point in time. Whether that information alone, just the two of them together, would have been relevant is questionable, given the fact that obviously it doesn't indicate that they were together 3 weeks or whatever it was, several weeks prior to that, for the burglary that was committed at the Five Guys Burger. But certainly, if the evidence was going to be admitted, the only relevance that could have been shown would have been for that, not all of the other information that was allowed in. The state really doesn't offer any justification here for the evidence that was admitted at trial aside from the fact that those two individuals were together. Nothing else is presented as a justification for the other information that was provided by the officer. The state is arguing, of course, that the error was harmless.
Was that objection fleshed out at trial in the same way that you're doing it now? In other words, saying, well, it should be carved out so that the officer can only say, yes, I've seen them together.
I think defense counsel was moving to exclude evidence of that incident altogether, certainly. But the trial court summarily denied that motion. There wasn't a lengthy discussion. And the trial court erroneously found it, it was relevant and not unduly prejudicial. I mean, those were certainly things that were raised before the trial court and the trial court rejected. And, as to whether, given the evidence in this case, the issue could be harmless, I just want to point out to the court that this is a case where, again, we have no eyewitnesses. There were no fingerprints at the scene. There was obviously additional evidence from the CCO believing that she thought it was Mr. Bowman in that video footage. But, again, she talked about the fact that she only made that identification after she was explicitly asked, is this Mr. Bowman? So the evidence at trial, she was given this information, right? She was sent an email and asked that explicitly rather than asked an open-ended question.
Oh, was this the email that went out when the officer obtained the picture and he sent it to a lot of people?
No, I think this was a more specific. My recollection is that this was a more specific email sent directly to her after he had some information, after another officer potentially identified Mr. Bowman as being in the, as possibly being the individual depicted. Uh-huh. A more specific individual email was sent directly to CCO Ricky, asking her, "This is your probationer, essentially. This is somebody under your supervision. Does it look like him?"
And well, did the evidence come in about that first identification, though? I mean, they found the surveillance, they got the surveillance photo and sent around a general question, right? Does anybody know this person? And wasn't there someone who immediately recognized Mr. Bowman?
who indicated he thought he did. His contacts.
Did he testify, or did that?
He did. That I believe who you're referring to is Detective Atwood, that did testify about the fact that he believed that it appeared to be Mr. Bowman. But again, his contact with Mr. Bowman was limited. And certainly CCO Ricky, although she tries to step back from this when she's talking about her testimony, one of the things she explicitly talks about is the fact that Mr. Bowman appeared to be the same individual because he was wearing, you know, the hoodie and the hat, which a lot of men in their 20s wear, she admitted. And she said, well, no, it's also the face. But, you know, in looking at this video footage and the still footage with the photograph of Mr. Bowman, it certainly wasn't that clear. And certainly she has a lot of people under her supervision, and she was making this guess. But given the lack of evidence otherwise at trial, there were a lot of conflicting things coming in. The fact that this extraordinarily prejudicial evidence came in about the fact that here were these same two individuals later at the same time of night in the same location, found by stopped by an officer with, you know, really.
You said there was a lot of other conflicting evidence coming in. What particularly are you referring to?
What I mean by that is that there was, while the state attempted, you know, while the state put on its case, there were other reasons for example, with CCO Ricky. Although she believed that it was Mr. Bowman, she really didn't know. There were no eyewitnesses, right? She was making her best guess based on the video. While they talked about the fact that there was a cell phone in the vicinity, that was just in the area. It doesn't mean that they weren't actually able to trace a call to Mr. Bowman. So a lot of the evidence they were using, they were relying, of course, on circumstantial evidence. And given how extremely prejudicial this one incident was, you know, we're asking for reversal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Raul Martinez, Deputy Prosecutor for King County on behalf of the respondent, State of Washington. Affirming Mr. Bowman's burglary conviction is appropriate here. I plan to talk first about the harmless error, and then I will briefly address the Bothell police contact, since it was addressed by counsel today. And if there's time, I will address the identification by the detective. We want this court to hold that even if the evidence of the Bothell police contact or the detective's identification of the co-defendant was improper, it was harmless as to the appellant Bowman in this case. Evidentiary errors only require reversal if they materially affected the outcome of the trial within reasonable probabilities. Here it's apparent that any errors were of minor significance when we compare them to the overall untainted mountain of evidence linking Bowman to these burglaries. Specifically, we start with the fact that Bowman's face was captured on a video surveillance camera after he crawled through a hole in the wall and looked up directly at this surveillance camera. A detective, Detective Atwood, who had met with him 8 times over the course of 8 years, looked at that surveillance image and identified him, quote-unquote, within seconds. And he specifically recognized the distinctive sharp jawline and cheekbones. Similarly, Bowman's own probation officer, who had met with him 8 times in the year before the burglary, so was very familiar with him, also recognized him in the surveillance image. And she also similarly recognized his sunken cheeks and distinct nose and jawline. And it really is the probation's officer that is the most damning in this case. She was acutely aware of his facial features because she had noticed, in her words, him deteriorate from a healthy young man to emaciated. In fact, she met with him the day before the burglaries, and she specifically talked to him about his appearance. She also recognized his clothing in the surveillance image was the same or similar to the clothing he had worn when she met with him the day before the burglaries.
That's not such strong evidence, is it? I mean, if you can't say it's exactly the same clothes, you know, people wear similar clothing generally from one day to the next. It doesn't seem like it says very much.
Well, Your Honor, if we take each individual component, I think that each individual component does raise an eyebrow. But it's really when you look at this in the totality of the circumstance that it becomes very evident why this jury convicted Bowman. You know, the evidence doesn't stop here. There was also circumstantial evidence that placed Bowman's cell phone in the area of these burglaries at the time that they were occurring in Kirkland at 3:35 in the morning. More importantly, or just as important, the cell phone was placed in the area of his Everett Mill Creek residence in the hours before and after the burglary, suggesting that he traveled to Kirkland to commit these burglaries at 3:35 in the morning and then went back home after the alarm was set off. So again, when we look at these pieces individually, I think that they're pretty compelling. We tend to think that they're pretty strong individually, but when you look at them together, it is apparent why this jury convicted Mr. Bowman of these burglaries. So given the strength of the untainted evidence incriminating Bowman, this court can conclude that within reasonable probabilities, the outcome of this trial was not materially affected by a detective identifying a co-defendant or evidence of both the police contacting these individuals 2 weeks after the burglaries.
Well, that seems to be the focus of the appellant's argument, so maybe you should address whether that was an error to admit the officer's testimony about being suspicious of them when they were seen together.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We do want this court to hold that the trial court didn't abuse its discretion by admitting evidence that they were contacted by the police several weeks after the burglary. As the court has already addressed, there was evidence the evidence was relevant, and it was relevant. The central issue in this case was identity. Could the state prove that the two individuals in this video were Bowman and Everson? And so the evidence was relevant to show association. The fact that they knew each other supported the reasonable inference that they could have committed the burglaries together. Now, evidence that is admissible can be excluded if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice. Because all potentially incriminating evidence is prejudicial, the focus is really on whether the prejudice is unfair. And when we look at that question, we look to see if there's any conduct suggesting a decision on an improper basis, and that's commonly an emotional one. And so here, there's a couple things we want to look at. We want to look at the evidence itself, and the fact of the matter is that this evidence was not evidence of wrongful conduct, much less criminal conduct. If we look at the evidence in its totality, what it was, yes, it was suspicious that these guys were walking around closed businesses at 3 in the morning, but the officer also testified that they said they were waiting for friends to check into a nearby hotel, and in the meantime, they were looking for food and gas. The officer corroborated that there was indeed a hotel 100 feet away and another one nearby. He also testified that they were not evasive, they didn't give false names, and that the contact lasted only 2 to 3 minutes before they were on their way. So if we look at this evidence, it's really not evidence of wrongful conduct. We have to look at all of the evidence, not just particular pieces of the evidence. Yes, it was suspicious, but if you look at everything that the officer testified to, they did nothing wrong.
Well, is there a rule that that it has to be evidence of wrongful conduct to be prejudicial? I mean, the question is, isn't this evidence so similar to what they were actually convicted of that even though at the time it didn't seem like they were doing anything wrong, that the jury could infer that it made them more likely to have been prowling around with criminal intent in mind at the time of the incident for which they were convicted?
Well, I think the key word there is infer. And while that may be an inference, the jury is bound to follow the evidence. And there was no evidence that they actually were casing other businesses. The evidence was to the contrary, that they had a plausible explanation for being there and that the officer let them go within several minutes. So the jury has to follow the evidence. And in this case, the evidence was to the contrary of any wrongful conduct. We also have to look at the way that the evidence was used, because essentially we're looking to see whether or not the prosecutor was suggesting a decision on an improper basis. And what we have here is the contrary. The state limited its use of this evidence to establish that these two knew each other and that it was the basis for the detective identifying Everson as a suspect. Nothing in the record shows any evidence was used to suggest a decision on an emotional or any improper basis. So for those reasons, we think that the evidence was admissible, it was relevant, and it was not unfairly prejudicial. The nature of the evidence itself had no wrongdoing component to it, and it was used for limited purposes improperly in closing. With respect to the identification of the co-defendant, I will just briefly say that the general rule is that a lay witness can provide identification testimony if they've had sufficient contact with a person to form an independent familiarity with their appearance. And the key phrase there is independent familiarity. Those are really two separate factors. They ask two separate questions. Independent is really asking, does this witness bring something new to the table that the jury doesn't already have? And familiarity is asking, does this witness know enough about this defendant to identify them in the way that they are identifying them? And so independent familiarity is the threshold for admissibility. When we talk about the quantity or quality of prior contacts, that goes to the weight of the evidence. So those are essentially the rules of the road, and the cases that outline that for us start with the seminal case, which is Hardy, where the officers knew the defendant for several years and were allowed to identify them in a surveillance video. This court looked to the federal version of ER 701 and its related opinion ID cases, and the cases cited by this court in its opinion spanned from those involving substantive relationships between the witnesses and the defendants, and those in Jackson, a case where a witness met the defendant once at a Christmas party and was allowed to identify him 2 years later in a bank robbery photograph. So if that is the spectrum of cases, and we can actually throw LaPierre in there, in which the Ninth Circuit said that it was hypothetically, they could hypothetically envision where a defendant, where a witness had no direct contact but just looked at photographs and still could make an identification. So whether we use LaPierre or Jackson, if that is the outside bounds of the spectrum, certainly our case falls within the range of permissible cases, where we have a detective who sat with the co-defendant for 45 minutes to an hour at a distance of 2 to 3 feet and interviewed him and then arrested him on another occasion. So it is the nature of that familiarity with this defendant that is something new, something that the jury did not have, and it certainly forms a sufficient basis to become familiar with him such that he can make an identification. We ask that this court affirm.
Thank you.
Just to address briefly the state's last argument in discussing the second issue and the state's reliance on Jackson, the state is wrong to suggest there is this spectrum when you're looking at this issue. In the Seventh Circuit case of Jackson, the court was actually just, you know, taking the basic ER 701 analysis and applying it to the facts and determined that in that case, not because we have this spectrum of contact and it's fine if it's just, you know, an hour that you're sitting with the officer can then make an identification on a video. That's not what Jackson is holding. Jackson is talking about the fact that if you applying that ER 701 analysis, it was helpful to the jury because in those circumstances, the individual looked very different than he had in the video. And so that was in part, you know, the basis for why CCO Ricky testified in this case. But, I mean, when we're talking about that, Jackson doesn't allow for the spectrum. It's an analysis of ER 701 as the other cases are. And the main point when we are looking at those cases and what Hardy says very clearly is there must be some basis to conclude that the witness is more likely to identify the defendant from the photograph than a jury. Right, so they have to be able to have both the rational perception, this reasonable perception that they've made of the defendant earlier, and also that their testimony would be more helpful than the jury. In this case, obviously, the jury was sitting there for, you know, 5 days with these co-defendants, and the officer at issue that was testifying about Mr. Everson had only seen him. He testified about an hour total, so a very limited period of time. And then to just, you know, go back and address very quickly, the state had talked about the fact that Detective Atwood had talked about this distinctive jawline. Just to be clear, I think the record shows that Detective Atwood did not talk about that. He talked about the fact he had had some brief contacts with Mr. Bowman, and when he saw the image, he thought it was Mr. Bowman. But the jury very well could have rejected that. He did not have very much contact with Mr. Bowman. The individual who's talking about a distinctive jawline, that was actually Detective Slominski, who was just comparing photos to the video. That's all, and had no, absolutely made no comparison based on his personal observations of Mr. Bowman. And again, the state relied on CCO Ricky. She talked about the fact that she only identified him after she was explicitly asked, and the jury should have taken all of that into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next case.